This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. We've got an interesting week of politics, unfortunately punctuated by a sad event. Jay, what happened?
Yes, we are all deeply affected and want to convey our condolences to the Bush family for the passing of former First Lady Barbara Bush. She had a long and really amazing career, independent in some ways of the fact that she was the First Lady, the spouse of a president, the mother of a president. She was kind of America's grandmother. But I think what's often forgotten is she was a champion for literacy and really someone who helped, I think, bring folks together in a really meaningful and cohesive way, and is certainly missed here in Texas, but I think missed across the country.
Yeah, she had definitely set a positive model for first ladies in terms of the humanity and compassion that she showed to the rest of the country. Her advice and assistance to the White House on AIDS policy and education really shaped those years for the president, and so she was definitely a fantastic partner. I'm struck by her commitment to her family, which I thought was above and beyond kind of things that we expect of a public official, and that really shone through in every case. She would give speeches for her sons who were out campaigning, and you could just see the kind of joy in her face, but also a willingness to speak her mind, and I think that is what really endeared her to a lot of people. We don't have enough, I think, of that in politics.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Her, there's sort of an iconic photograph of her embracing a baby with AIDS, sort of the first time, sort of a public official. It's not unlike, I think there's a similar sort of picture when Princess Diana did this very similar deal in the UK and sort of changed the way people viewed people with AIDS. She, you know, had a remarkable life, as you said, you know, being the daughter of privilege, living out in West Texas.
She agreed to drive to Midland, Texas.
Exactly.
That's
right?
How much you can tell she loved former President George Bush, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Brandon, shifting gears a little bit, we've had a lot of international related events happen this week that I think sort of changed certain dynamics globally. What happened in Syria?
Yeah, the biggest event this week was a reaction to the use from the Assad regime of chemical weapons. The president, in concert with other nations, enacted a unilateral policy strike, missile strike, against certain specific bases in Syria with the hopes of limiting or truncating the ability to produce chemical weapons. The president, at the end of this, tweeted out that, you know, this was a well-done mission. He thanked our allies in Britain and France, and then said something that presidents have gotten in trouble for in the past, and that is that mission accomplished. So what do we make of this? I mean, is this really mission accomplished, or is this the president's kind of wishful thinking?
Well, I think in the sense of this particular mission, i.e. this particular set of strikes, they completed it with no casualties. And so if you just were to look at it from those four corners, that element is done. But no, we're nowhere near mission accomplished as it relates to Syria and as it relates to deterring Syria from using chemical weapons. I think this is the first of many kind of back and forth. And as it relates to that, we know there was some back and forth with even what the U.S.'s response vis-a-vis Russia and Iran would be, because U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley announced there was going to be enhanced sanctions against Russia as it relates to their response in Syria. And of course, very quickly, the White House said, absolutely not, we're not going to do it.
Right. I think it underscores the schism that there is between the president and the national security team. The old CIA director, new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is going to have to figure out how to organize this. But I don't think that this is over by a long shot. I mean, if the president really wants to solve this problem, they're going to have to put boots on the ground. And that's something that he has specifically said that he wouldn't do. So that would be a dramatic reversal. I think it would cost him politically, domestically. And I think that beyond that, too, the president really here is in a tough situation because he didn't get congressional authorization. There's still uncertainty about what the UN wants to do about this. So they really had to tread lightly. So mission accomplished only is for this one moment. And it's a lot of wishful thinking.
Yeah. And to underscore your point about the issues with the national security team, General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, apparently wanted to go see congressional authorization, was overruled by the president. And the new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo himself, sort of shifted gears in his previous role. And he played a little shuttle diplomacy, right, Brandon? What's going on there?
Yeah, well, while you all were gouging yourselves on chocolate bunnies, Mike Pompeo was visiting in a top-secret mission North Korea.
You think there was chocolate there? were there chocolate bunnies
I assume
there?
He brought the chocolate with him. I mean, that's what I would do, because those bunnies take a long time to eat, right? Yeah, so this is interesting because the U.S. has no kind of formal diplomatic relationship with North Korea, but obviously there's been some flare-ups the last year. The president's gone back and forth on Twitter with the dictator in North Korea. I don't know, Jay, is this an opening of negotiations for some kind of an interaction? Does this bode well for the kind of peace deal between South Korea and North Korea? What's going on?
Yeah, I think it a couple things. One, it is a precursor to the planned meeting. I don't want to call it a summit, but the planned meeting between Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, and President Trump. The president himself, I think, tweeted out that it might be sometime in June.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's this whole series of conversations that have to occur at lower levels before anything goes forward. The big issue is the question of how one defines denuclearization. For the Americans, that's always been a dismantling of any nuclear program. For the North Koreans, I think it's a moving target of what that actually means. But you also raise that point that there is, for the first time in a very long time, talks of formally entering into a treaty and ending the Korean War in the Korean Peninsula. As we know, the Korean Peninsula itself is only divided north and south based on an armistice. There's technically a state of war between the north and the south. So there are positives that are coming out of this. We'll see what happens. But we see this every so often.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Jong-un, sort of, there's initial threats against the world. The world reacts. They talk to him. And then it suddenly, we see much more talk about diplomacy. So we'll see ultimately what happens here.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, Trump is uniquely positioned to be able to deal with this. It's a sort of Nixon to China moment, right? I mean, he's been so, you know, boisterous on North Korea. And maybe this is his time to say, like, okay, well, only I can solve this because I was the one who really pushed them. And here I can send sort of these private envoys. To some degree, there's some hype here because there was concern that Pompeo wouldn't get the nomination, right? He wouldn't get confirmed by the Senate, given some of the things that he's done and said. And also Congress, I think, is really trying to hold the president's feet to the fire on some of these foreign policy issues. So this, I think, probably distracts from some of the confusion and contradictions in the foreign policy that the president has put out there. And I think it also kind of lets us look away from the ignominious departure of Tillerson that preceded Pompeo's ascendancy to the position of Secretary of State.
Well, Brandon, let's shift gears a bit. Talk about our home state of Texas, all the good, the bad, the ugly, all that stuff.
Lots
that's going
of bad,
on.
Actually.
A little bit of bad, right?
Week,
so
right?
We know we've had this ongoing problem with our Department of Health and Human Services. And that as a consequence of all of the sort of the errors and the investigations and the firing of people of the board, speaking of, we've talked about fixers a little bit. Governor Abbott has decided to send his fixers, former State Senator Tommy Williams, to fix all the problems there. What do you think?
Yeah, they need it more than anybody. This agency is a wreck. They've had problems in 2014, 2015 with contracting. Now, new revelations have come out that they've inaccurately calculated final evaluation scores for five vendors and have failed to verify vendors' reported qualifications on big bids, right? Especially important ones like collecting vital statistics, which the state needs to be able to go to the federal government to say that this is how much money we qualify for. So it is just a mess, Jay. Something's got to get done.
Yeah, folks out there need to understand that if you look at the state of Texas budget, with the exception of education, we spend pretty much everything else on healthcare and healthcare related events, right? So about 40% of our overall budget is in this area, welfare, healthcare related issues, all that come under this one agency. And so it's critically important it functions correctly.
Yeah.
So
this is a mega agency, right?
It's
agency. HHSC spends more in their budget than 45 other states spend total.
Like, exactly. I mean, you think about that context of that, right? And this is one of the things that I think from a political perspective that's often lost. You can criticize the governor for a lot of things politically. One of the things that I think he's not doesn't get enough criticism for is the fact that agencies across the state are failing. We've had problems in the TEA.
Yeah.
We've had problems in HHSC, mm-hmm. Health and Human Services.
Alcohol and beverages.
Alcohol
right?
and beverages. Probably about 75 to 80% of the budget of the state of Texas from an administrative perspective has been called into question here, all under the watch of the governor. And so it's really interesting to me that you don't hear any sort of public criticism from other elected officials, from the Democrats. You would think they would be sort of chomping at the bit at this. So it's a little bit surprising to me that we don't get more pushback.
That's a great point. I mean, this is what they do all day. They manage, they govern, right? This is where the, you know, cow eats the cabbage on that stuff. So I don't understand why it's not the case that people aren't talking about this more frequently. This is in particular an agency that deals with like our federal interface, right? A third of our budget is come from the federal government because we have individuals who need this money and they qualify through HHHC and the related rulemaking. So I don't, this is really critical. This is our money, right? We pay federal taxes so that we can have access to these programs. The Texans who need it have to get it, and it has to go through HHSC. They have to work properly. Well, Jay, we're in NBA playoff season, but sometimes the game doesn't end after the whistle's blown. What's going on?
Yeah, Greg Popovich, the coach of the San Antonio Spurs, is really one of the most vocal, politically speaking, of NBA coaches. And it's taken a pretty strong stand against President Trump and for sort of general social justice-related issues. It's sort of brought in, I think, the ire of some of the Trump faithful, especially in the San Antonio area. They feel like they have to make a choice between cheering for the Spurs and cheering for Donald Trump, and sort of made for some interesting conversations back and forth.
Yeah, Coach Pop has been pretty pointed in his criticism. He's called Trump an embarrassment to the world and said that he's a soulless coward and a psychological or pathological liar. Pretty impressive stuff. I suspect you're going to lose some fans. That's how it goes. But if there's any public official with more support that's more durable than Donald Trump, it's Greg Popovich, especially in San Antonio. That's what you get when you bring home multiple championships to your team, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Pop is a beloved figure there. And on the same note we talked about earlier, we want to express our condolences. He lost his wife within the last couple of days. And so for the Popovich family, we express our concern and for their family and for the entire Spurs organization. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the governor's race, what's going on statewide.
So, Jay, we've got a couple of really interesting statewide races. We've got a governor's race. The Democratic side is still in runoff. And now we've got also a competitive race, apparently, in the Senate side. So we'll see how that goes. Let's first talk about the governor's race. And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that the governor got a little bit pwned by the governor of New Jersey in this op-ed, right? Abbott said, you should all come to Texas. We have low taxes and sunshine. The New Jersey governor pushed back in some pretty strong language.
Yeah, absolutely. So Governor Abbott, as part of the larger attempt to try to lure businesses here, puts out these op-eds in various local newspapers across the country. He took a pretty aggressive shot at the state of New Jersey as a high-tax state and invited businesses to come to Texas. The governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, took great offense to it and then proceeded to put out an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle and other statewide papers in Texas and just, I think, pretty aggressively pushed back on some of the less than favorable statistics that we have in Texas, you know, 43rd in education, 21st in business climate, just a whole series of things where New Jersey's frankly ranked higher than Texas.
Right. He can't be that surprised that people are making fun of New Jersey, right? Like this can't be a shock to him, right? But Perry did the same thing too, right? Perry got a lot of pushback from other states, California and New York, where he was trying to poach jobs. So it's not uncommon that this gets some redirection. But on your point, is Abbott really doing well as governor? Some polling suggests yes, but the debate still continues about who should be the Democratic nominee, even though Abbott has his own perspective. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so there was a poll that came out, put out by Quinnipiac College, relatively a reputable polling service. And it essentially said that while the governor remains popular, around 53-54% favorability, he's in a pretty close race. He has a 7-point advantage, 48-41 over Andrew White, and a 9-point advantage, 48-39 over Lupe Valdez. Both those numbers are of great concern to the should be a great concern to Governor Abbott. He's below 50 in both, and he's essentially in relatively close distance to people that nobody has any idea who they are.
Yeah, I think that's right. We have our own problems with this poll, which we'll talk about when we talk about the statewide poll, but Abbott's pretty popular, according to this, 51% fave and 54% approve. So he's definitely in good shape there. But he is really driving to get Valdez the win, right?
Yeah,
he said
absolutely.
Specifically that he wants her and assumes that she is the front runner, in part because of something he said that this week, and that is that he thinks that her approach on sanctuary cities is completely backwards. She shot back that said that this kind of fear-based open borders nonsense isn't going to work, and that we need to focus on bigger issues. What do you make of the fact that he's trying to pick the winners in the Democratic side of things?
I think it's pretty standard for opponents to want to try to pick who they perceive as the weakest opponent.
Yeah.
We saw that.
The numbers bear this out.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
She does worse than Andrew White against him.
I think slightly worse. I think the interesting thing to me is because we've seen this before. We saw it years ago in a Missouri Senate race where Senator Claire McCaskill was aggressively, her PAC was supporting the weakest candidate.
Right.
Harry Reid in Nevada did a very similar thing.
Cut an ad for him.
Yeah, like, exactly. Cut an ad for the opponent that he'd like. And so you create a circumstance where it makes it easier for you to run. And Valdez clearly creates a sharper contrast for Abbott. Her signature issues are things that he likes to talk about. He's a lot less, I think, sure-footed against Andrew White, who has sort of billed himself as more of a common sense Democrat. And he's also a business community guy versus another public official. So it creates a sharper contrast. And it's harder for Abbott, I think, to go after him. So it's interesting that Abbott's doing it. So he won't mention Andrew White at all, but he'll be talking about Lupe Valdez a lot.
Yeah, of course he wants to run against her. She's easier to paint as being like too liberal, right? And that's a problem for her in the general. My question here is about the Democratic Party. There's been reluctance to engage in debate. This is not just their issue, but also an issue for Valdez. Does the Democratic Party want to let it look like Abbott's picking the nominee? That makes it look like they're inept, and I think that's a major problem. The other part of this is that she seems to be ignoring him, just the way that Abbott is ignoring him. That is White. White came out this week with a pretty ambitious plan, a $9 billion plan to improve public schools. It includes teacher pay raises, scholarships, and also it decreases the reliance on high-stakes testing and a whole host of other things, including all-day pre-K. So this is interesting because he's out there pitching plans. She hasn't been doing that. Is this really a race, or is this just a coronation for Valdez with the presumption that the Democrats want to nominate somebody who is able to generate enthusiasm amongst younger voters, more liberal voters, and possibly Latinos?
Yeah, look, I think it's a situation where White is putting out a lot of policy suggestions, policy proposals. He's trying to generate earned media out of it, and I think it's worked largely. I mean, that's to his credit. He's trying to run an idea-driven campaign. I think she recognizes she has structural advantages in the party. A lot of the traditional Democratic Party infrastructure supports her. I don't think there's any evidence at all that she's going to mount a serious race in the fall. I'm not sure that many Democratic leaders want a serious race in the fall because I'm not sure they want Greg Abbott to be that focused on the race. But I think the larger issue here, Brandon, is that the Texas Democratic Party itself is essentially kind of this empty vessel. It's not really organized well. It's not structured well. And I think they're just putting out someone without any real rhyme or reason. And so I think they're just trying to get through this process. They have no ability to force a debate when everyone, I think, recognizes that it makes perfect sense to have one.
Yeah. I think it's problematic for them. I mean, she's only getting 51% of support from Latinos. White gets 49%. So the fact that they're not really making big dents in those numbers is problematic for them going forward. Well, Jay, on the same poll that I was just mentioning, we also have numbers that say that the Senate race is basically neck and neck. O'Rourke is within the margin of error of Ted Cruz. I don't think it's passed the sniff test, but what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things wrong with the poll, and we can talk about that in terms of the model they're using. I do think there's some issues related to the fact that the race is relatively close, probably closer to about 7-8. I'm not sure it's within the margin of error because there's structural advantages for Ted Cruz. But this race is set up to be close, largely because Ted Cruz is just not a popular figure.
Yeah. The poll asks questions of all voters, not likely voters, so you're getting a different skew. It also has a high percentage of people who self-identify as independent, and that's something you typically don't get when you kind of model the electorate. So the way that they're asking these questions probably is giving them these results. But to be honest, there's some things in here that could be problematic for O'Rourke. The biggest is, again, still the people don't necessarily know who he is. 53% don't have enough information to give a favorable or unfavorable opinion of him, including 44% of Democrats, Jay. And leadership skills, 48% don't know if he's a good leader, including 34% of Democrats. These aren't great numbers, and so I think that's a real problem.
Yeah, the way I looked at the poll, I think, is less a statement about O'Rourke or even White or Valdez, and much more about a cause for concern for both Cruz and Abbott, in the sense that they have 100% name ID. Everyone in Texas knows who they are. And the fact that relatively high percentages of general voters are less than inclined to vote for him, a vote for either of them, is a problem. Now, I think you're right, because we talk about this. Elections are decided not by all voters. They're decided by people who actually show up to the polls. While we know Democratic intensity nationally is up, the mix in Texas has still favored Republicans. So that's one of the reasons why I say, do I think the race is tied? I don't. But I certainly think it's within 6 to 7 to 8 points, which for Ted Cruz is still a lot closer than it should be.
Yeah, and just to amplify your point, Cruz does better among people who are likely to vote than O'Rourke does. Cruz is better in the over 50 crowd. He gets 53% of the vote. And white voters, he gets 59% of that vote. O'Rourke gets 55% of Latino votes and 50% of young votes. Actually, the young vote number is pretty low for him, considering where things are. So Cruz, I think, in terms of what the electorate's going to look like, is probably still in good shape. But I do agree with you. I think this is going to be a closer race than a lot of people think.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to tell you why this polling and these races in general are so important.
So, Jay, we talked a little bit about where the state of play is on these statewide races. What do we take from this, and why should people care?
Well, look, I think there's two things here. One, there has been this sort of prevailing narrative that there is a sort of blue wave sweeping across the country. What I think this says and reinforces is that we have competitive races in Texas now, something we haven't had in a very long time. We may or may not have it in the governor's race, but I certainly think we have it in the U.S. Senate race. And we've got congressional races that are driving this all across Texas. I think we're at a sort of interesting inflection point in Texas political history now, where we may be seeing the beginning of a shift. So it's important, I think, to recognize that we may be seeing something that we didn't expect to see.
You know, I'm curious to see kind of when the interactions occur. We've had sort of each side saying what they think the other side is up to, but we haven't had a real interactive debate. I'd like to see that happen, not only just from within the parties, but also between the parties. So far, there's been a lot of kind of thrusting and parrying, but not a lot of actual substantive debate. So I look forward to the point where we can have a competitive discussion about this, because I do think these races are going to be competitive. Maybe not at the end of the day, like a 5-6 point, although maybe the Senate race, but I do think that an exchange of ideas is critical here, because that's what's going to sharpen our expectations about each party and give us some ideas for how to govern Texas in the future.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Gary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Any questions? Shoot us a tweet with the hashtag Party Politics Pod or email us at partypoliticspod@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks to our super producer, Edel Howland, who always wins debates, and to our audio engineer, Todd, the big debate, Hulslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.